You use mine. Will swallows. Very well, Mr. Dorian says. It has no effect on Amit's abilities. Well, allow me then, says Brogan snidely, thumping onto the stage. Will's head snaps back as the trick scarf is dragged from his head. He hasn't felt such mortal danger since he was chased through the forest. He forces himself to meet Brogan's gaze, praying that the man will not see the secret behind his eyes. His heart thrashes against his ribs. Will looks at Mr. Dorian, who says something to him in Hindi for good measure. Will repeats one of the three phrases he's learned, and Mr. Dorian nods. The brakeman's scarf reeks of tobacco and hair grease. Brogan ties it tightly. With difficulty, Will swallows, but knows he must remain calm. That's it, he hears Brogan say. Let's see him draw.
A portrait of you, sir? Mr. Dorian asks.
Nah, he's had a good look at me. Let's see him do this lady here. Come on over, darling, and have your portrait done. Stand right here in the magic circle.
A huge whoop rises from the bloodthirsty crowd, and laughter, too. They're with Brogan now, wanting a good show. A great wall of blackness separates Will from the world. Within him, panic cavorts up its spiral staircase.
And get that girl away from him, Will hears Brogan say behind him. She's probably telling him things.
Of course, says Marin, and Will hears her come closer and press the pencil and sketchbook into his blind hands. Very quickly, with the point of the pencil, she traces something across his palm. Was it the letter B? B for Brogan? Is it a trick, then? There's no woman standing behind him, just Brogan himself? Will takes a breath. Even if he's right, does he know Brogan's face well enough? He tries to recall its details, but they're all out of focus. Putting his pencil to the paper, he instantly feels calmer. His shoulders unclench. Blind, his hand travels more quickly than usual, the tip of the pencil never leaving the paper. Following the conjured contours of lips, then nose, then eyes. With a flourish, he rips the page from his book and holds it aloft. He feels Dorian take it from his fingers and hold it before the saloon.
Ladies and gentlemen, behold his psychic powers!
Applause and mocking laughter roils from the crowd, as well as some jeering. Is it directed at him or Brogan?
The boy got you there,
he hears someone cry out.
He did you good!
Will feels the scarf being gently unwound from his head and is surprised to see Brogan before him, staring at him intently. In Brogan's hand is the portrait. Will can't help but take a quick peek at his own work. Not half bad. The brakeman forces a smile and pats Will on the head, his thumb rubbing hard across Will's brow.
That's a good trick, lad,
he whispers. His breath smells like pickled eggs. Will raises his eyebrows, feigning ignorance, but he worries his fear transmits itself through his pores.
Is this man proving troublesome, Mr. Dorian?
Will's gaze snaps instantly to the imposing form of Samuel Steele, his scarlet uniform ablaze amidst the crowd. The Mountie's eyes are fixed on Brogan. The brakeman stiffens at the sight of Steele, and then his eyes slink over to Mr. Dorian, awaiting the ringmaster's reply. It's all Will can do to keep silent.
No, Lieutenant Steele, Mr. Dorian says cheerfully. A circus always welcomes audience participation.
Very well, then, the Mountie booms out to the crowd. Comport yourselves in an orderly manner. Any damage to person or property will be dealt with very severely. Also, any low moral behavior.
His eyes stray to the gallery, where the painted women smile down at him angelically. Brogan retreats to the bar and sits watching the rest of the show with his back to the counter and an unnervingly serene look on his face. Samuel Steele remains in the saloon. Will is glad to escape behind the curtain. For the finale, Marin appears once more on stage, to whistles and kissing sounds, to perform the disappearing act. Mr. Dorian makes sure to choose a female volunteer to come and tighten the chains, but the cheeky miss can't resist chatting up the audience and shaking her lacy pleated skirt. She strokes Marin's bare shoulders and says,
Ooh la la, isn't she a fresh young thing, gents?
Will wishes Marin would disappear all the faster. Mr. Dorian covers her with a scarf.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure performing for you here today. I hope that you will cherish fond memories of the Circus Dante. And when we next appear in your town, come and visit us properly, and you will see that the wonders you have sampled here today are but a flicker of the full flame.
And when he whisks the scarf off Marin, she is gone.
Will you ever tell me how it's done?
Will asks when she appears behind him.
You'd be disappointed, she says. Isn't it better just to wonder about some things?
I don't know,
says Will. They put their coats on, pack up quickly, and leave the saloon, escorted by the gangly porter. Samuel Steele nods at Will as he passes. Will is glad when the heavy door to third class is bolted shut behind them, though he knows it won't stop Brogan. He still feels the pressure of the brakeman's calloused thumb across his temple. Did Brogan rub some of his face paint off? Will hasn't had a chance to check himself in a mirror. A short, bustling porter escorts them through a carriage lined with crew berths and maintenance compartments. Then, to Will's surprise, he opens the door to a blinding abundance of sunshine and sky. Men and women stand against the railings of a roofless, flatbed carriage, taking in the view of the rolling prairies. Breathing deeply, Will smiles. After being inside for so long, it's wonderful to feel a breeze against his face.
Observation car?
Marin asks the porter.
No, miss. This is the shooting gallery.
Looking closer, Will now sees rifles in the hands of the passengers. At the far end of the car, there is a large cabinet of more firearms. A man pays some money to a steward and selects one.
What do they shoot?
Asks Marin.
Oh, sometimes they just like shooting off their guns, says the porter. Soothing to some folks, I suppose. We pass wildlife from time to time, and it's good sport to see if they hit anything.
Will looks to the far horizon. There is something hypnotic about it. Nothing but grassland, showing the first signs of green after the long winter, and the tracks of the boundless cutting through it like a scar. The blue sky sits atop it all like a dome.
Do you hear something?
He asks Marin. It's difficult to tell above the din of the train, but he senses a deep, earthly vibration as much through the soles of his feet as in the air. And then they come. On the left side of the train, a dark wave crests a hill and swells toward them. Massive bundles of hair and brawny shoulders and horned heads. Their hooves thunder on the ground.
"Looky here!"
bellows one of the passengers, raising his rifle and taking aim.
"We're going buffalo hunting!"
The prairie has become a dark, roiling sea. For a moment, Will wonders if the sheer force of them will capsize the boundless, for they're coming head-on. But at the last moment, the animals veer off, charging alongside the train. All the passengers push for position against the left railing now, firing shot after shot into the sea of buffalo. To Will, it seems like the most senseless and unsportsmanlike thing he can imagine.
"I think I downed one!"
a man shouts.
"Me too! Look at that!"
another bellows. Will sees one of the mighty beasts crumple at the front legs, plowing dust and earth before it. Other buffalo careen into it from behind. Will glances at Mr. Dorian and sees, beyond the familiar calm of his expression, a pale fury.
"This is how you exterminate a people," the ringmaster says bitterly. "You kill all their food."
"Indians!"
one of the passengers shouts. Hard on the heels of the massive herd come dozens of natives on horseback, some with rifles, others bows. They divide the herd expertly, shunting it in new directions. Will spots a young brave brandishing his rifle angrily at the train.
"We'd be wise to go inside now,"
the steward shouts from the front of the carriage.
"Not when the hunting's this good,"
says a fellow, taking another shot.
"Damn redskins,"
shouts another passenger with a flushed face and small, close-set eyes.
"They're steering them away from us!"
In horror, Will watches as the fellow takes aim at the closest native and fires off a couple of shots. Mr. Dorian steps forward and grabs the barrel of the rifle.
"What are you doing, sir?"
he shouts, his eyes blazing.
"Just a warning shot is all," says the man belligerently. "What's it to you?" They rely entirely on these hunts for food and hides. Well, I'm not taking their buffalo, am I? I'm helping them. Not by shooting at their hunters. What's one less Indian?
Snorts the man, just before an arrow buries itself in his heart. He staggers back, dead before he hits the ground.
Or one less white man,
murmurs Mr. Dorian. Panic breaks out across the car. Some men run for the exit, but most reload and start shooting at the natives.
Stop this!
Shouts Mr. Dorian at the passengers. The ringmaster's face has lost all composure. The color is high in his cheeks as he snatches one man's rifle and cracks it across his knee.
Stop this, you fools!
Everyone inside!
Shouts the steward again, in vain.
Mr. Dorian, sir!
The porter calls out.
Come inside, now!
With a cacophony of gunfire, the natives converge on the train. Arrows slit the air. Will crouches low and grabs Marin's hand.
Come on,
he says, pulling her through the panicking crowd toward the next car. Will smells singed fabric and notices a tendril of smoke curling from his small suitcase, just inches from his chest. He looks up in alarm. Through the churning bodies, he catches a glimpse of a man at the railing, a cap shadowing his face, his rifle trained on Will. Will tenses at the sound of a dozen simultaneous shots, and suddenly Mr. Dorian is in front of him, his thick cloak swirling before Will like a cape. A rifle bullet falls from the folds of the coat and dances across the floor.
Run! Now!
Mr. Dorian shouts. Will bolts after the ringmaster, trying to stay low. As Will nears the door, he sees a native rider pull fearlessly alongside the carriage on an amazing black horse. Its speed is incredible, outpacing the boundless, passing unscathed through the barrage of rifle fire. The hunter pulls back his bowstring and shoots one of the passengers, then pulls another arrow from his quiver and notches it. An instinct makes Will grab Marin and push her down. There is no sound as the arrow embeds itself in the wooden post behind where Marin stood seconds before. She looks at Will, eyes wide in astonishment. Suddenly, a voice, and Will never thought a voice could be so loud, carries above the shouts and rifle reports and train clatter.
Put down your weapons at once!
Will turns back to see the scarlet figure of Sam Steele striding across the platform, anvil-sized pistol raised high. He fires off a warning shot.
Weapons down, do you hear? Or I will open fire upon you and mow you down.
He turns to the native hunters.
And that goes for you, too. This ends now.
The gunfire ceases at once. And then Will, panting, is being pushed inside the next car by their porter. A group of sweaty men talk jubilantly about their skirmish. Uniformed stewards are pushing through the crowd to assist the Mountie.
You'll need to hand over the rifles now, gentlemen,
one steward says, taking the guns from the reluctant hands of the passengers.
These are the property of the Boundless and for use only on the shooting car.
We showed those redskins,
one of the passengers whoops.
We showed them!
The porter leads Will and Marin and Mr. Dorian through the car. Will's knees are wobbling, and Marin, too, looks badly shaken. She puts her lips to his ear and whispers,
Thank you.
As the porter shows them inside their compartment, Will is hardly paying attention. Mr. Dorian locks the door and then parts the curtains, peering out onto the prairie. There's no sign of buffalo or the natives.
Lieutenant Steele seems to have put a quick stop to the madness,
he remarks, his face still drawn. He looks at Will.
That wasn't a native that shot at you. You know that, don't you?
Will nods.
I think it was Chisholm. I caught a glimpse of him. It was a perfect chance to kill you in the confusion. No one would have known.
Will looks at the bullet hole in his suitcase and feels ill.
Thank you, he says. You saved me from that second shot.
A good coat serves many purposes, the ringmaster replies.
They know who I am, Will says, fighting panic. They're going to come for me again.
Quite possibly, yes,
Mr. Dorian responds. Will blinks. He was hoping for a shake of the head, some kind of reassurance.
But they won't attempt anything during the day,
Marin tells him.
They just did,
Will exclaims.
We'll change compartments before nightfall,
Mr. Dorian says.
Until then, I think it might be wise to spend as much time in public areas. The busier the better. Let's begin with a visit to the dining car. Both of you must be famished.
Eating is the last thing Will feels like doing. Someone has just tried to kill him. But after Marin changes out of her tightrope costume, the three of them venture out to the dining car. Second class, though still a far cry from the luxury of first, is a lot more comfortable than third. The corridors have wood paneling and fabric wallpaper. Thick carpet cushions Will's footsteps and insulates the carriage from the noise of the tracks. The windows are larger and the gas lights more numerous. In the dining room, Will feels people's eyes on him and recognizes a pair of men from the shooting car. Everywhere Will glances, he thinks he sees Brogan or Chisholm or Mackey. When the meal arrives, it looks delicious, but Will is afraid to eat it. How does he know one of Brogan's men hasn't crept into the kitchen and drizzled poison all over it? Enviously, he watches as Marin tucks into her chicken pie. She catches him looking and notices his uneaten food. She seems to understand what's worrying him because she raises an eyebrow, forks some of his food into her mouth.
"Pretty good,"
she says, and then swallows. Will eats. Everyone is talking about the gunfight with the natives, and Will hears all sorts of gossip flitting between tables. 10 passengers killed, 15 natives, 3 passengers, 2 natives. The brave jumped aboard and scalped a steward. Sam Steele leaped onto a native horse, chased off the hunters, and then reboarded the Boundless with a tomahawk. Will feels better after his food. Having all these people around almost tricks him into believing he's safe. He could stand up and walk off into his normal life. Toward the end of the meal, Sam Steele strides into the dining car and speaks to one of the senior stewards before moving forward up the train.
"Ladies and gentlemen," the steward says, "Lieutenant Steele has asked me to pass on the news that there was a brief skirmish with some Indians. 2 of our passengers were tragically killed."
Gasps of horror engulf the dining car. Men thump the table and vow bloody revenge. Mr. Dorian eats, staring rigidly ahead. The 2 men from the shooting car look over darkly, and Will thinks he hears them muttering the word half-breed. He stares longingly in the direction where Sam Steele disappeared. Forward. He catches Marin looking at him anxiously. Is she worried he'll make a run for it? He wants to, but he won't. They've saved his life 3 times now. He's made his promise to Marin, and he means to keep it.
"Nearly had him," says Chisholm, nervously forking some meat from a tin. "All lined up, and then Dorian waves his coat in front of him. How does a coat stop a bullet?"
"You should have let me take the shot," says Mackey. "I wouldn't have missed the first time."
"Ease up, Mackey," Brogan says, flicking some food from between his teeth. "Sounds like it was a tough shot."
He's angry about Chisholm's cock-up, too, but he wants to jolly him along, especially after nearly drowning him in the muskeg. He needs all hands on deck for what's coming. The 3 of them have fallen back to Peck and Strawn's brakeman's cabin, not far behind colonist class.
"We won't get another chance like that," Mackey says sullenly.
"Maybe we don't need one," Brogan says.
"What do you mean? You said we needed to take that boy."
"Oh, we're gonna take him, all right."
"So what's the plan?"
asks Chisholm, his eyes bulgier than usual.
"When I was in the saloon car, that Mountie was right there. I thought I was sunk. Why didn't the boy go to him? The boy wants something, that's why. Or Mr. Dorian does, more like. He's got his hands on a key to the funeral car. I reckon they've got their own plans."
"I don't like this waiting," Mackey says.
"That Dorian can disappear things," says Chisholm. "How we know he won't disappear what we're after? And himself?"
Brogan thinks about this and shakes his head.
"That's magic," he says. "And I don't believe in magic."
After the porters have made their last rounds, putting the train to bed, Will, Marin, and Mr. Dorian slip silently out of their compartment. Luggage in hand, they move 5 doors back and enter a smaller, empty room. After bolting the door behind them, Will starts quietly helping the others pull down the sleeping berths.
"When are you doing it?"
he asks as he spreads a sheet and blanket over the middle bunk.
"The robbery."
Mr. Dorian takes out his watch and consults its 2 faces. During the afternoon, he several times asked the stewards about the train's precise location and speed.
"We need to be inside the funeral car no later than 4 o'clock this morning."
"You can just stay here, Will," Marin tells him. Lock the door behind us. No one knows where you are. We'll be back before breakfast.
Will shakes his head.
I'm not staying here alone. It's best if you don't get mixed up in this, Will, she says.
He laughs.
Could I be any more mixed up? I'm coming with you. I'll feel a lot safer.
Mr. Dorian regards him.
I warn you, Will. You might regret your decision. I have a feeling we may run into resistance.
Still, it's not a hard decision to make. He's truly horrified by the idea of being left alone in the compartment. Even more, he wants to be there to help Marin if she needs it.
I'm coming, he says again.
Very well. I suggest you both get some sleep.
You're not sleeping?
Marin asks the ringmaster.
Not yet.
Later, under the covers, Will is still wide awake. The gaslight has been turned low. Marin shifts above him, already asleep. Opposite him, Mr. Dorian stretches out on his berth, fully clothed, writing. He looks over and sees Will watching.
Will you be young forever?
Will asks.
After your portrait?
I think not. The portrait ages, and presumably when it reaches a goodly age, it will die, as it were.
What happens to you, then?
Mr. Dorian looks up from his
writing. Perhaps all my years will catch up with me, or maybe I'll just start aging again
normally. That would be an unexpected
bonus. I merely want my allotted years, William. Is it greedy to want
that? Will doesn't know the answer.
Marin says you have big plans for the Zirkus.
Mr. Dorian smiles, and it's a different kind of smile from the impassive ones Will has seen so far. This is the kind you get when you're thinking of your favorite thing.
Yes,
he says.
I'd like to open circuses overseas and add more animals to my menageries. Make Noah's Ark look paltry.
He chuckles, and Will laughs too.
You must be the only person with a Sasquatch.
I believe I am for the moment. But there are always more animals and more marvels to collect. Imagine if I could trap a Wendigo.
Have you seen one?
Will asks, caught up in the ringmaster's enthusiasm.
Not yet, but I plan to. And there's a man in the Far East who can fly. Imagine that, William. Flight! I hope to enlist his services before Mr. Barnum does. Everything on this earth I want to gather, and every feat that's possible. A new world to let us escape our own.
There's a wistfulness, Will thinks, in his last words. The ringmaster folds his piece of paper away inside his pocket, and then writes a brief note on a second piece.
Just a little message telling my circus friends how we're faring,
he tells Will.
How's it going to reach them?
Will asks quietly.
A favorable tailwind,
Mr. Dorian replies. As Will watches, Mr. Dorian folds the paper in half lengthwise, then makes a series of other folds, ever more complicated and ingenious. When he's finished, he has something that resembles a goose. He pulls a little tab at the tail, and its wings flex and quiver expectantly.
It really flies?
Will asks, incredulous.
It really does.
Mr. Dorian goes to the window and slides it open. Night air, tinged with coal smoke, gusts in. The ringmaster puts his face out, turns it from side to side, then makes a slight adjustment to the paper wings. And then he launches his bird into the air. Will wishes desperately he could somehow follow its journey. If he could, he would see the paper bird swoop up, wobbling slightly. The train shuttles past so quickly it's hard to tell if the paper bird is moving at all, but occasionally the wings give a flutter or flare and the bird rises and banks. The cars flash past beneath it. The paper bird soars toward a brakeman standing atop a freight car, smoking. He squints, then reaches out to grab it, but the bird veers around his outstretched hand. Farther down, another brakeman sees it and, thinking it's a bat, punches it with his hand, sending it tumbling through the air, away from the tracks. The bird rights itself and flaps, but the train is far away now, and the mindless paper craft just keeps sailing straight ahead into the night. But perhaps it's cleverer than it appears, for straight ahead comes the last half of the Boundless, still rounding a big curve. The paper bird banks slightly to come in line with the train. Whatever paper mechanism animates it now seems to falter. The wings stop fluttering, and slowly the paper bird begins to sink, toward the roof of the freight cars. Lower and lower it glides until it flies right into some kind of web jutting from the window of a car that says, Zirkus Dante. It's not a web, but a native dream catcher, and the paper bird is tangled snugly in its threads. The dream catcher is pulled swiftly inside. The paper bird is unfolded. The note read. Chapter 13. The Funeral Car. Will feels a hand shaking him awake.
It's time, says Marin.
The gaslight is turned low. She's already dressed, as is Mr. Dorian, who's slinging a coil of light rope over his shoulder. Hurriedly, Will pulls on his trousers beneath the covers.
Sure?
Marin asks him when they're ready to leave. He nods. Mr. Dorian takes up an unlit lantern and unlocks their door, and they slip out into the corridor. Will feels like a ghost as they make their way through the sleeper cars. On both sides, thick curtains are drawn across berths, muffling the sounds of snoring, murmuring passengers. Will's eyes sweep from side to side, terrified that an arm will shoot out at them. Every cough and snuffle makes him start. Mr. Dorian has a sixth sense for avoiding the few porters and sleepless passengers who come their way, ushering Will and Marin into washrooms or empty berths until it's safe to emerge. The dining car is deserted, all the tables already laid with linens and cutlery. As the three of them pass the kitchens, Will glances through the round window in the door and sees long, gleaming counters and blazing ovens and pots as tall as smokestacks, spewing steam. Already the cooks are chopping vegetables and kneading bread for the breakfast onslaught. Every time they're ready to cross to another car, Mr. Dorian has them stand back while he peeks through the window to see if a brakeman is poised on the roof, watching. Then he quietly opens the door and the three of them dart across the couplings. In the laundry car, the air is heady with starch and bleach. Line after line of tablecloths and sheets and uniforms silently sway to the motion of the train. The fabric glows in the pale gaslight. Watching the shadows, Will hurries through. At the door to the next car, Mr. Dorian pulls back suddenly from the window.
There's a man on the roof,
he whispers.
Brogan definitely wants to know what we're up to.
They wait several minutes for the brakeman to move along, then several more.
He's not budging, says Mr. Dorian. We need to distract him.
I've got an idea,
Will says. He retraces his steps into the laundry room. He takes a starched white shirt from the line and slides open one of the windows. After feeding out the shirt, he closes the window tightly so half of it flails about in the wind, like a man wildly signaling for help.
Nicely done, says Mr. Dorian. Let's see if he bites.
They return to the carriage door and wait. Will kneels and peeks out the window. The tip of the brakeman's cigarette flares orange. Then there's a sudden movement of the head, and a lantern flares. The brakeman jumps over to the roof of their car and treads in the direction of the laundry room.
Now,
Will says. He pulls open the door and leads the way across the coupling to the next carriage. Inside, Marin smiles at him.
That was a good idea. You're quite an accomplice.
I'm not an accomplice,
he says, shocked at the idea.
Anyone who helps is an accomplice,
Mr. Dorian points out. Will frowns, then chuckles softly.
I suppose so, then.
He knew Van Horn pretty well. Maybe the old fellow wouldn't mind if his painting were stolen. After all, the rail baron always had a flair for the extraordinary. He was so full of life himself. No doubt he'd have been miffed to know he could have had more. But he'd also like all the intrigue his painting was causing. When they near the end of second class, Mr. Dorian stops them and says,
"We need to go to the roof now. There will be porters on guard at the border, and we mustn't be seen."
Will knew this moment was coming, but he is not looking forward to it.
"Are you ready for another walk atop the Boundless, William?"
Mr. Dorian asks.
"The train's a bit slower now. We're slowly rising toward the mountains. The route's dead straight."
Will nods.
"I've done it before. I figure I can do it again."
"That's the spirit. We need to move as swiftly as we can. There may be other men on the roof."
At the next coupling, they cross, and Mr. Dorian climbs the ladder. He pokes his head above the roof, takes a good look each way, and then gestures for Will and Marin to follow. Despite his coat, Will shivers as the wind meets him atop the boundless. He steadies himself. The passenger cars are different from the box cars. They have no running boards, and their roofs slope down even more than the freight cars. There's a fingernail clipping of moon, and Will can see only a few feet ahead of him. Mr. Dorian does not light the lantern. Good for staying hidden, terrible for jumping cars. Mr. Dorian walks with ease, and Marin strolls along like she has no cares in the world. To a tightrope walker, this is nothing. At the end of the first car, Will watches as Mr. Dorian and Marin make their jumps, getting swallowed up in darkness. Only the lanterns along the train's sides tell Will that the Boundless is still moving in a straight line. He quickly rubs the Sasquatch tooth in his pocket. He can barely see the other car as he takes a run and launches himself into the night. For a second, mid-jump, he feels a hot pulse of vertigo, but then he's coming down and Marin is waiting to offer a steadying hand.
"You did it," she whispers.
Car by car, his confidence grows, his body reacquainting itself with the train's restless pitch and sway. Up ahead, Will catches a flicker of lantern light, maybe three cars distant. He moves to touch Marin on the shoulder, but she's already turning, and he sees Mr. Dorian jabbing his finger to go backward. Will crouches and hurries back to the end of the car.
"Down,"
he hears Mr. Dorian whisper. Will climbs back to the platform, stands to one side of the car door so no one can spy him through the window. Marin and Mr. Dorian quickly descend and join him.
"He may not have seen us," says Mr. Dorian. "We'll go past underneath him."
He checks the window, opens the door, and ushers them inside. It's strange for Will to be back in first class again. It feels like a different world. Or maybe it's the same world, and it's him that's different. He's dressed as an Indian spirit artist, part of a band of thieves come to rob the funeral car of a rail baron. He looks around, trying to figure out where they are, and then catches a whiff of roasted almonds and popcorn.
"The cinema's just up ahead," he says.
Stealthily, they pad along the plush-carpeted hallway. Edison bulbs glow from behind decorative pink shades. The trio reaches the end of the car. Marin checks the rooftop and nods at the others, and they silently open the door and cross to a double-decker car. Inside, the sound of water greets Will. He climbs six steps to the black-and-white tiled deck of the swimming pool. The silver fountain in its center sends spray into the fish-flecked water. The only light comes from the pool itself and casts undulating pale blue reflections on the ceiling. Will follows the others along the deck, past the cloth changing tents. From the far end of the car, above the noise of tinkling water, comes the precise metallic sound of a doorknob turning. He grabs Marin's hand and pulls her inside the nearest tent. There's a zipper to close the flaps, but Will doesn't want to make any noise. Through the narrow crack, he sees Mr. Dorian disappearing into the tent in front of theirs. Climbing the steps to the deck, a brakeman comes into view wearing a peaked cap. Even though Will can't see his face clearly, he thinks it belongs to Mackie. In his hands is a long metal pole with a pronged end. He stands for a moment, listening. Walking slowly along the deck, Mackie casually swings his metal pole into the first changing tent. With a smacking sound, the heavy fabric puckers deeply. He moves on to the second changing tent, strikes it hard at chest level, keeps going. Will watches in horror as Mackie nears Mr. Dorian's tent. Will grips Marin's hand tightly. The brakeman hits the tent hard. The fabric dents, and an almost comical squeak comes from inside.
"That really hurt!"
"Come out here," barks Mackie, taking a step back and adjusting his grip on the pole.
Will expects a bloodied Mr. Dorian to stagger out, but no one emerges.
"Out!"
Mackie snaps. He strikes the tent again at knee level. Another high-pitched yelp comes from inside, and then,
"Come and get me!"
Mackie scowls. With the end of his pole, he parts the flaps, and then strides in, ready to wallop. The moment he's inside, Mr. Dorian, to Will's huge amazement, steps out of another tent altogether. With one swift movement, Mr. Dorian zips Mackie into the tent and delivers a high kick. The tent topples over, thrashing. Mackie curses from inside.
"Give me a hand!" the ringmaster calls out.
Will runs over with Marin, and they take hold of the tent and bundle it into the pool. Exotic fish dart away like colored bolts of lightning. The fabric is soaked within seconds and proceeds to sink.
"He'll drown," Will says,
but already he can see Mackie's hand thrust from the churning tent and start to unzip the flaps. Outside the swimming pool car, Mr. Dorian leads them once more onto the roof of the Boundless. On the double-decker cars, Will feels the sway of the train more strongly, twice the distance to fall. Slowly, his eyes readjust to the night as he pushes himself to keep up with Marin and Mr. Dorian. He knows the three of them need to put distance between themselves and Mackie. Heart hammering, he makes his first jump and lands in a crouch, slightly off-center. By the third jump, he starts to feel more confident again. He tries to keep track of where they are in first class and guesses the dining cars. Up ahead, he spots the pale glow of the terrace car, gas light still burning faintly inside. Several minutes later, they leap onto it, the place where he stood just days ago as the train left Halifax Station. It seems like a memory from someone else's life. Through the domed glass, he sees a solitary gentleman dozing in an armchair, his hand still closed around his glass of brandy. Another jump, and another. Beneath him, the parlor cars, the billiards room, the library. And there, ahead of him in the long distance, is the locomotive. Rising above the coal-packed tender, it's a small engine city, a symphony of pistons, its vast smokestack reaching into the sky. Too hastily, Will makes the next jump. His feet have just left the roof when the wind shifts and a cloud of soot and heat washes over him, singeing his eyes. He blinks furiously and sees the next car curve away from him. A grunt escapes his throat as he stretches out his arms. He hits the corner of the roof with only one foot and crashes onto his shoulder, scrabbling to grab something. Marin hears his cry, turns, and throws herself toward him. Sliding along the sloped roof, she seizes his wrist. She is small, but he feels her amazing compact strength as she pulls. With her help, he gets both feet against the roof and pushes himself to the center of the car.
"Careful," she says, leaning her forehead against his.
Breathing fast, he nods and follows her. Before long, he realizes he's walking over the top of the bedroom he spent all of one night in. And after that, the cars become single deck again, and the three of them have to proceed more quietly than ever, for these are maintenance and crew cars, where the porters and stewards will soon be waking and preparing for another day aboard the Boundless. Will can see the ornamental metal plumes of the funeral car now, and after another two cars, they've arrived. He climbs down after Mr. Dorian and Marin to the small, juddering platform. At his back is the doorless end of a maintenance car, and before them, the darkly gleaming steel of the funeral car.
"Stay back," Mr. Dorian warns them.
There is a great deal of noise from the tracks, but Will is aware of an extra vibration, electricity coursing through the metal exterior. The ringmaster pulls out his timepiece and examines its hands.
"We have 35 minutes.
"Until what?" Will asks, but Mr. Dorian ignores him and lights his lantern. Marin crouches and removes her coat, taking out her amazing spool of wire. It was one thing to talk about it, even to imagine it, but now that Will is peering beneath the funeral carriage, seeing the speed of the ties as they clatter past, feeling the sway and shudder of the train, he feels terror for her.
"You don't have to do this," he says.
"Shush!" She pulls on rubber-soled slippers.
"You never say that to someone before a performance."
"This isn't a performance," he says.
"She trained for this," Mr. Dorian reminds him.
"Are you even sure there's room?"
"It can be done," Mr. Dorian tells him. "I made careful measurements."
Again, Will stares at the tiny, hurtling space and imagines her falling.
"Why can't you wait until we're at a stop?" he demands.
"It has to be now," Mr. Dorian says sharply.
"Why?"
"That's enough, William."
"But this isn't safe," Will exclaims, suddenly trembling with fury. "If it's so important to you, why don't you do it? Be quiet."
It's Marin who speaks, and Will turns in surprise to her angry face.
"Go if you want," she says, "but stop interfering."
His face burns as if he's just been slapped. He was trying to protect her, and she treats him like a squalling baby.
Go ahead, then!
He snaps to cover up his hurt. He feels close to tears. He wants to climb the ladder and head back to first class, leave them to their death-defying feats and insane robbery. But he stays put. As Marin slides toward the edge of the platform, he takes the key from his pocket and hands it to her.
Here. Use the original. It might work better. Thank you, Will.
Mr. Dorian arranges the shutters of his lantern to send a strong, skinny beam into the whirling world beneath the carriage. Oiled steel and truss wires and spinning metal rods and the clattering din of the ties hurtling past. Marin turns the handle of the spool. The rigid wire extends, longer and longer.
Remember, you can't touch any part of the undercarriage, Mr. Dorian warns her.
She nods and pays out the miraculous wire, guiding it beneath the bottom of the carriage until it hooks across a horizontal rod on the far coupling. She secures her end to the underside of the platform. She has her tightrope. In a single fluid motion, she swings herself onto the wire, arms held out, balancing on her back. Her feet, in their rubber-soled slippers, push her deeper under the train. Her legs can only bend slightly, so they don't hit the steel undercarriage. The ringmaster lies flat so he can angle the light for Marin. Will presses his cheek against the cold metal to see better. He dares not say a word. The train jolts, and Marin sways violently, hands dancing through the air. He wants to plead with her to come back.
"The lock is coming up now,"
calls out Mr. Dorian calmly, for Marin can't see what is behind her.
"Another few pushes. There."
Marin balances beneath a black box. She takes the key from her sleeve. Swaying side to side in sync with the train, she inserts the key into the lock and turns. The faint buzzing in Will's ears ceases.
"You've done it, my girl," breathes Mr. Dorian. "You clever girl, you've done it. Come back now, and carefully."
The return trip is no less anxious for Will, watching as Marin slides back, though this time she can reach up with her hands and use the undercarriage to balance and propel herself. She slides out onto the platform and springs to her feet with a huge smile. Will can't help wrapping his arms around her and squeezing her tight with relief.
"I'm sorry I snapped at you," she says into his ear. "I'm just glad you're safe."
"Let's hurry," Mr. Dorian says.
They climb the ladder to the roof and walk forward. Mr. Dorian fastens his measure of rope to a metal rung and rappels swiftly over the side. Will watches as the ringmaster traces the dense metal foliage with his hands and finally inserts the key. A section of the car pops out and slides back, flush. The ringmaster swings himself inside.
"You go," Marin tells Will. "I'll hold the line still for you."
"Thanks,"
Will says gratefully. If someone told him days ago he'd be lowering himself over the side of a hurtling train car, he would have laughed and wished he had the courage. But he has it now, even though his hands are sweaty with fear. He stares back up at Marin, and the mere sight of her gives him confidence. Mr. Dorian is waiting for him inside the hatchway and seizes his arm to pull him in. Within seconds, Marin stands beside them. Mr. Dorian lights his lantern again. The interior is heavy with a cloying musk, candle wax, dust, furniture polish, and a faintly sweet odor that Will fears is the slowly decomposing remains of Cornelius Van Horn. The carriage reminds Will of pictures he's seen of a pharaoh's tomb, all manner of things piled and jumbled about. A chair and footstool that must have been favorites, a tall urn with peacock feathers, a chess set with the pieces set out as if about to be played, a battered pair of snowshoes, the taxidermy of a beloved dog. Hanging from the wall is a large framed photograph. Will walks closer and gasps. It's a photograph he's never before seen, but he is its subject. It's from Craigellachie. There he is, front and center, the hammer frozen just as it connects with the head of the last spike.
"That's incredible," Marin says. "How come no one knows this?"
"Donald Smith liked the other photo better," says the ringmaster. "Even though he just bent the spike, and it needed straightening."
"But this one's the truth,"
Marin says, smiling at Will. He thinks there's admiration in her eyes, and he drinks it in. He's never really made much of the story. has never seen it as an achievement of his own. He just happened to be sitting there on the platform at farewell, and Mr. Van Horn took a liking to him.
"The last spike of the railway," she says. "You're sort of famous."
"No," he says. "I did nothing to build it." Will sees Mr. Dorian's eyes sweeping the walls.
"Where's the painting?" Will asks.
"Not here. He loved it a great deal. It will be farther in."
The ringmaster moves to an inner wall that, Will realizes, must divide the carriage in half. In its center is a metal door that looks like the entrance to a bank vault.
"We'll never get through," Will murmurs. "We've no key to that. Can you pick it?"
Marin lets out a deep breath and shakes her head.
"No need," Mr. Dorian says, surprising them both. "The lock is on a timer."
Faintly, Will hears a tick emanating from within the door, where two clocks sit side by side.
"You'll see," says Mr. Dorian, "that the first clock has our current time, and the second, the time and date when we arrive in Lionsgate City. The clock is timed to open only then."
"So what are we to do?"
Will asks, exasperated. If Mr. Dorian has known this all along, why on earth has he led them on this fool's journey? Mr. Dorian consults his watch.
"As I've shown you, time is an unreliable thing. In 5 minutes, we'll be passing between time zones."
Will remembers how the hands faltered on his watch.
"But I was never sure if that was just
a trick," Mr. Dorian asks with a smile. "The universe plays the best tricks of all."
"You knew all along about this lock?"
Marin asks, amazed.
"Of course," replies Mr. Dorian. "I know the man who designed the lock. Me."
"So when we pass through the time zone," Marin begins,
"the hands will falter, the clock will stop, and for a few moments the lock will think we've reached our destination, or at least have no notion of time at all. In either case, it will open."
The sound of slow applause makes Will whirl. Brogan stands behind them, clapping. Flanking him are Chisholm, a knife gripped in his jittery hand, and Mackie, his damp clothes plastered to his powerful body. Brass knuckles rim his right fist. Brogan holds a pistol.
"Good thing we let you lead the way," Brogan says. "The key was just the beginning, wasn't it? I didn't realize there'd be more trickery inside. You're the real key, ain't you, Mr. Dorian?"
Will can only stare, taking in the bulk of Brogan and his men.
"That's a nice disguise, boy," the brakeman says. "I knew when I saw you in the saloon. I knew you were up to something. I wondered to myself, why ain't he talking to that Mountie? And then I knew you wanted something from that funeral car. As much as me."
Mr. Dorian says,
"That was a fine piece of deduction, Mr. Brogan."
"So go ahead. Work your magic."
"I don't believe in magic, sir."
"Do what you need to do and open that door."
Mr. Dorian consults his watch, and Will glimpses the double clock faces, one terrestrial time, the other cosmic.
"What is it you're hoping to find inside, Mr. Brogan?"
the ringmaster asks calmly, still inspecting his watch.
"Never you mind. You just get us in."
"I see no reason why we can't all walk away happily with our prizes."
Brogan laughs sarcastically.
"How do you know we're not after the same thing?"
"I gather you're after gold. You've no interest in that, I suppose?"
"Not at the moment."
"Lucky you." "How's this work, then?"
Brogan demands.
"We just have to wait a moment."
Brogan glances nervously at Mackie.
"Watch him, boys. He's cunning."
And then Brogan puts his pistol against Mr. Dorian's temple.
"Don't try your tricks on me, my man."
"I wouldn't dream of it."
Will looks at Marin, thinks of the gun going off, and how easily the bullets would pass through her. Through all of them, their flesh so soft and helpless. Mr. Dorian holds his timepiece up for all to see.
"Here it comes, gentlemen."
It is a strangely dramatic gesture, but everyone looks up. Will's eyes rivet themselves to the second hand of the clock.
"Any moment now," says Mr. Dorian. any moment. You'll feel it when it's upon you.
Stop talking! Shouts Brogan.
Will sees the strain on the brakeman's face, the lines stretching down his cheeks like dried riverbeds.
I know what you're trying to do!
There's nothing at all I need do, says Mr. Dorian soothingly. It's completely beyond my control.
Stop talking,
says Brogan again, but his voice sounds muted now.
Nothing at all to be done.
The strangest feeling wells up within Will, as though his senses want to float free of his body.
Any moment now,
he hears Mr. Dorian murmur quietly, a small voice a long distance away. Will sees the watch's second hand pause and tremble. He's aware of the thunder of the tracks beneath his feet, unnaturally loud, but rising above that is the slow tick of the vault door. He drags his gaze over to it, feels as though he's moving through water. The first clock embedded in the metal door falters and stalls. From within the door comes a surprisingly dainty click, like fingers being snapped. The moment is just a moment, but it contains multitudes. The carriage seems to expand around Will. He's aware of Marin beside him, and the hulking presence of Brogan and his two men. Curiously, only Mr. Dorian seems absent, but then he is right beside Will, his hand reaching out to take the wheel on the door. It spins with such beautiful slowness, the lantern light flashing off the spokes. The door drifts outward. Will's nostrils fill with a deep metallic odor, and then the clock hands begin moving again. With a sharp intake of breath, Will comes back to himself. Brogan snatches Mr. Dorian's lantern and waves his pistol at them.
Inside!
As Will steps through, he hears a metallic thunk from the door. He sees that Mr. Dorian has noticed too. There's a look of surprise in his eyes, but there's no time to ask him what this sound means. Light darts about from the impatient lantern. Compared to the antechamber, this room seems empty. In its center is an enormous sarcophagus. Will spent the last 3 years in a port city that whispers ghost stories. Ghost lighthouses and ships, drowned mines, hauntings and forerunners. But never has he had a stronger feeling that he is in the presence of the supernatural. It's a tingling in his toes, a weakening of his joints, and a faint but insistent whine in his ears that quickens his pulse. The lantern light sweeps over hanging photographs of Van Horn's family, and then Cornelius Krieghoff's The Blacksmith's Shop. Will glances at Mr. Dorian and sees his eyes fixed to the canvas, like a desert wanderer spying an oasis.
"Fancy that, do ya?" says Brogan. "Well, you'll have lots of time to admire it. Boys, let's get what we came for."
"It's the spike, isn't it?" Will says.
Brogan sniffs.
"The spike?
You tried to steal it in the mountains."
"Oh, I'll have the spike, but that's just the beginning."
Brogan's eyes narrow.
"Your father never told you, did he?"
The train judders, and Will takes a step to keep his balance.
"Told me what?"
"In the mountains. We weren't just building the railroad. We was digging for gold, your father and me. The railway was bust, boy. Van Horn was a desperate man. No one would bail him out. Us men hadn't been paid in 2 months. You remember going hungry, don't you? What did your ma feed you those months?"
Will does remember those times, when they ate the same flavorless soups and stews because his father sent no wages home. Without their mother's factory work, they would have been turned out on the street.
"Van Horn was a desperate man. No one would give another penny for his blessed railway. But he heard from some Indians that there was gold in the mountains. He set a team of us working to blast tunnels to see. And we found gold. By God, we did. Enough to save his railway. But he kept it secret. Didn't want people to know he was saved by sheer luck. And whether that gold really belonged to the company, well, that was a thorny question. One thing's certain. Didn't see Van Horn with soot and nitro on his hands. That fat cat soaked in the sweat and blood of others, and I hope he's drowning in it now. We mined it, and Van Horn took it. But there's plenty left over.
This car ain't just carrying a dead man.
Brogan swings his lantern so it illuminates three large crates against the rear wall. One of them is open, revealing the sly luster of gold bars.
That's what your father was going to use to launch the steamship line across the Pacific, says Brogan. But I'll have it instead.
You can't, Will says, his outrage sudden and fierce. You can't steal from him!
I dug up that gold, Brogan roars. Same as him! Why shouldn't I have my share of it? I didn't get no promotion. I didn't get handed the railway like your pa.
He saved Van Horn's life, Will retorts, and he worked for what he got. He's no thief like you.
Will feels the nauseating fork of pain in his stomach before he even knows he's been punched. He's on his knees, gasping, streaming tears. Brogan spits beside him.
Thief! You ask your pa if he slipped some of that mountain gold into his pocket. If you ever see him again.
He turns to his men.
Fetch it up! All them crates to the doorway!
Mackie hasn't taken two steps before he stops short. From within the sarcophagus comes the sound of someone dragging a breath into his lungs. Will jerks as the lid slides violently back. Marin's fingers grip his arm and bite deeply. His whole body feels struck by lightning. From the darkness of the coffin, Van Horn rises. His mighty beard and sideburns obscure his shrunken face. A jacket hangs loosely about his collapsed chest. His once powerful hands are webbed with flaccid skin. As though he's in the grip of a seizure, his torso quivers, then gives a great twitch, and Van Horn springs upright like some diabolical jack-in-the-box. There's a crackling sound, a sudden acrid odor, and a terrible high-pitched gagging emanates from Mackie. His back arches and lifts him onto his tiptoes, chin angled high, as though being yanked by some invisible chain. His damp clothes steam. His arms tremble stiffly at his sides. The tendons in his neck stand out like knotted twine. To Will, the sight is almost as terrible as the corpse towering before him. Chisholm grabs Mackie to drag him back, but the moment he touches his stricken friend, they seem welded together, and he too makes horrible choking sounds. Will looks back at Van Horn's corpse, half convinced it's working this devilish effect on Brogan's men. But he sees now that it's merely a mechanical wonder, like the ones he saw in the Zirkus car.
It's just a puppet! Brogan bellows at his men.
They're being electrocuted, Mr. Dorian tells him calmly. It's a trap.
Brogan levels the gun at Mr. Dorian.
I thought you turned it off!
This runs off a separate battery.
There's another snap, and Brogan's two men collapse to the floor. Without turning his back on Mr. Dorian, the brakeman warily kicks at his fallen companions. They groan and tremble, their wide eyes unblinking.
They'll recover, says the ringmaster. You needn't worry.
As Will watches, Van Horn's swaying corpse silently stretches out its skeletal hand and closes it around Brogan's forearm. Brogan whirls with a cry and tries to pull free, but with a metallic ratcheting sound, one finger after another locks around the brakeman's flesh. The puppet's arm is stiff and freakishly strong, holding Brogan at a distance from the sarcophagus. Brogan whirls on Mr. Dorian in fury.
You knew about this!
Of course. I helped design this room for Mr. Van Horn.
Get me free or I shoot!
I'm afraid I won't be doing that, says Mr. Dorian.
Brogan squeezes the trigger. The hammer clicks. He squeezes again and again. Six empty chambers.
Difficult to fire a gun without these, says the ringmaster, holding out the bullets as if returning them to Brogan.
Brogan lunges for them, but is brought short by Van Horn's grip.
You'll be released when we reach Lionsgate City. He turns to Marin. The painting, please. Don't touch the floor. Beyond where we stand, every inch is booby-trapped.
Like a cat, Marin springs across the carriage and lands on a small bureau near the wall. She lifts the painting off its hook and flings it toward Mr. Dorian, who catches it. Then she leaps nimbly back beside Will. Mr. Dorian is already savagely knocking the Krieghoff painting from its frame. Taking the hide scraper from his coat pocket, he slits the canvas right off the stretcher. He hurriedly folds it and crams it inside his jacket. His hands are shaking.
"We're leaving," he shouts, ushering Will and Marin out ahead of him.
"Don't be a fool,"
Brogan shouts.